Hi, my name is Bruce Bolger. I'm founder of the Enterprise Engagement Alliance, one of the leading organizations dedicated to a strategic and systematic approach to achieving organizational goals through all the people in your organization. And part of our EEA ongoing series are evergreen how-to articles with leading experts in different areas of engagement to help people at any time get on demand the type of information they need to make more intelligent decisions. Because, as we all know, when it comes to engaging people, there's about 20 or 30 different tools and tactics involved with that process, just like there is in any other thing in business. So before we get started, I just want to thank, as always, our customers. They don't actually pay for these programs. This is something our company does. But these are the companies that provide various types of engagement tools and services that use our services. And then finally, we are ourselves stakeholder capitalists. We give away a ton of information. This terrific meeting with two experts that you're going to meet in a minute. In fact, I'll get back to that slide. I jumped through it too fast. The whole purpose is to make this information free and available to you. So to get back to our two guests, before I end this slide thing here, we've got two people, Thomas Bertels, and somehow your names disappeared from this slide. Incredibly. So sorry, I did this very quickly. Thomas is a founder and president of Purpose Works Consulting. And I'm sorry, Ellen Frank Miller, she's founder and CEO of WORK, which stands for Workforce and Organizational Research Center. And folks, as you know, I had to do these slides very quickly. I had forgotten to do them. So again, I'm going to stop now the share, and we are going to now meet our panelists. So thank you so much. Ellen, I'm going to start with you. What is job design and how is it different from employee experience, incentives, rewards, and recognition, and all the, frankly, a lot of fluff we see in social media?
When we think about job design, we think about a job description, right? And oftentimes those are written in kind of a quick way when we look at what are the things we need someone to do. But a job description is not job design. Job design is thinking about what are the tasks that someone will perform on a regular basis in their role, and how do we structure the way in which those tasks are executed so that the person has variety in what they do, they have autonomy in how they do it, and they have a way to connect the incentives that are provided to them, whether that's compensation or benefits, to the actual product that's ultimately produced by the organization so that they connect their effort to what the company or the organization does and the output and therefore the meaning, in their work. So I'll stop
That's
there.
beautifully done. By the way, folks, we have two experts. Both of these companies specialize in helping companies design jobs. And Ellen's, in particular, also does research related to that, just so you know where they're coming from. Thomas, I think she gave a pretty good description of that. I'd like to invite you to add to it, but then tell me why no one has ever heard, I've never heard of really anybody knowing about what job design is. So flesh out anything that she might have said and maybe help me understand why people don't understand what job design is.
Yeah, I think job design, I think, is one of these best kept secrets, right? That actually have been, I think, around, the research has been around for like 50, 60 years now at this point in time, right? I mean, it goes back to really the organizational development movement that started like in the 1950s, 1960s, right? So Douglas MacGregor and Frederick Hertzberg and so forth, that I think really laid the foundation for helping us understand like what makes a good job and what are the conditions that really allow people to perform it at the peak. And Ellen pointed out, right, I think it's about autonomy, it's about feedback, it's about meaningful work, right? And we oftentimes don't really make smart, intentional decisions about how to structure work in a way that it delivers against those intrinsic psychological needs that we all have. And so
Well,
I
and
think
let
the
me ask
designs
you
of
that,
job design, yeah, please.
where we're going to delve more into that. Why do you think most companies overlook this?
I think there's a number of reasons. I think one is people don't know, right? I mean, you talked to that already. We don't teach it in business schools. Managers get very little training, right? I mean, most people that get put into management roles don't even get much training in terms of how to lead people, right? Let alone how to structure work to bring out the best in people. So I think that's a starting point. The other topic is that, you know, when you actually change how work gets done in an organization, it's a little bit like touching the third rail, right? Because now you start a conversation around, I want you to do something different. If I change the shape of your work, am I going to get paid more? Right? How does the whole employment deal change? And so I think that's something that I think a lot of managers are afraid of.
So, Ellen, getting again into the granularity of this, since most of us aren't trained in this, okay, I don't think in a 1 hour webinar we're going to be able to teach people how to do this granularly. But one of the things, I enjoy ballet, but I can never imagine how do they choreograph it? How do you take ballet and show it? So same with job design. So let's say I hire you or Thomas's company to help me design jobs, okay? What is the process that you would use to do that? And I'm going to ask you the same question, Thomas, so we get two different viewpoints. And then how do you choreograph that? Does the employee, does the manager get a page with graphs? What is this? How do we conceptualize job design into a practical tool?
Well, I really appreciated what Thomas just brought up about the awareness or the low awareness about job design and the ways that that then plays out in organizations. And as you know, you said, most people become managers without receiving training about being a manager. And one thing that we know from the research, and there was some very interesting stuff that was published. It was in the Journal of Applied Psychology in 2019. There was also an article about it in Harvard Business Review. And it has to do with when managers or those who are responsible for designing jobs, when their jobs have very little autonomy in them, in other words, when their jobs are very structured, regimented, and they don't have a lot of opportunities to make their own decisions about how they'll execute work against their goals, they then turn around and design low autonomy jobs. And we know from the research that low autonomy is highly correlated with reduced, you know, turnover, reduced engagement, reduced burnout, et cetera, you know, lower.
You mean reduced retention, I think you meant, anyway.
Yeah, sorry, reduced, you know, lower, higher levels of turnover. Turnover, lower levels of engagement, higher levels of burnout. When you don't have autonomy in your role, you're really set up to fail. And there's a cascade effect that happens. So there's a couple of places that we start. The first, of course, is, you know, with the most senior level of management, to have them understand that, you know, creating jobs in an intentional way has a business benefit. Then when we start to talk to managers who are responsible for designing those jobs sort of down the org chart, we try to help them understand that the way that work gets done matters, not just the output, but the process. And as I mentioned, you know, I think meaningfulness, a lot of that is generated from people's autonomy, the task variety, the opportunities they have to, you know, have input into how the work gets done. So we have managers understand the importance of engaging employees in the process of designing their jobs. When managers then are given more autonomy in their roles to manage their workforce, it allows them to be a little more open and creative to how they can create autonomy in those frontline roles. And that then basically we use worker voice and we raise up worker voice to provide the feedback. And, you know, anyone who's been in a store, you know, any kind of retail store can tell you that if you want to know what the problem is in the store, ask the person who's actually working the floor. Don't ask the area manager because they don't know. So raising worker voice is a key tool to then actually executing job design or job redesign within the organization.
So it sounds to me, and I'm going to turn it over to you, Thomas, for your view on this, that job design is a continuous process. In other words, just because I've created a job doesn't mean that I'm not going to use autonomy and voice to continuously improve that job in an ideal situation. But I'm going to get back to this issue of how to choreograph this so that a manager, okay, once we've designed that job, how does everybody know what that job is? But Thomas, your view on, I'm going to get granular now. We're going down the, we're peeling the onion now. I want to get a little bit more into, okay, how do I do this? If I'm going to call you in, I've convinced the CEO, I'm going to design jobs that are going to improve retention, improve willingness to refer, that are going to make people more productive. higher quality, and that I can that create value for my organization? How do I do that rather than shooting from the hip and leaving it to some lower level manager who's just going to bake in her ignorance or his ignorance into the design job?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's a couple of ways to look at this, right? I mean, one is, right, let's talk about maybe the scope, right? Are you doing this across the entire organization? Or are you just doing it for a pocket of the organization or even for a specific job? If you do it at the job level, your design space is fairly limited, right? Because again, jobs don't exist in isolation. They're people that provide inputs, the outputs go somewhere else, right? So I think a typical strategy really is to do that at a larger scale, let's say at a business unit. And start out with really, what's the core mission of that organization? What are the core products that it delivers? What are the outcomes that are being generated? And then try to understand what are the processes and workflows that deliver that. And then I think oftentimes opportunities reveal themselves to take work that has been incredibly fragmented, because we've all been applying Tayloristic thinking to this and right, brought jobs down to the lowest common denominator, where we can pay people the least amount of money, and put these jobs back together so that somebody can do the entire job from start to finish, or a team of people can do it from start to finish. And as you tear apart these work processes and dive into that, you oftentimes see that there's a lot of activities that, quite frankly, add very little value. They're not mission critical, right? So there's an opportunity to take things out of the process and eliminate non-value added work, and then really put it back together and give people the entire job to do. And then many people stop there, but the real opportunity is then to take that forward and actually connect the employees or a team of employees that owns the entire process from start to finish to the customer of the work. So for example, let's say you're an insurance company, right? You create a team that now, whatever, is responsible for a product line or a certain customer segment. And once you connect them to the customer, then you can open up the feedback channel. So people actually get feedback from doing the work itself. And you know that again also has many benefits, right? Because if people know how they're doing, then you probably don't need as many supervisors and managers to tell them what to do, when to do it, how to do it, right? So I think again, it's like you start out with like define the mission, you understand the work products, you take the process apart, you look at opportunities to put Humpty Dumpty back together and give people a whole job. And then you really need to start looking at how much autonomy can we give people in executing this task. In some industries, there are limitations to that, right? But in others, you can really make the job quite meaningful and autonomous.
And we'll get to that. So what I'm hearing here, okay, yes, you can use these processes of purpose, goals, and objectives for an individual job, but the bigger opportunity is to look at it from a systems point of view, because people interact with one another. And so if you can really step back and dissect it, you might actually reconstruct everything, it seems to be what you're saying. And then what you're saying is give that customer, that employee, continuous feedback from the customer. And we all know that a customer can be an internal customer just as much as an external customer, right? So that's all great, if I've understood you correctly. So Ellen, getting back to you and getting back to, if assuming you agree with this general approach, how do we, again, choreograph that? What if I hire either one of your companies and I either hire you for a systems assignment, or I just want to restructure, I've got this assembly line job, I've got massive turnover, I'm paying people as much as I really can, I'm paying them good money, but I'm still getting a lot of turnover, I need your help. What can I do with that job? So let's, maybe before I get back into what that written document, with that, how you would choreograph that, what would both of you say, and I'll start with you, Ellen, since it's your turn, are the key elements of job design to make a job meaningful? What if you had to stack out the seven things, you know, you said right away, Thomas, a sense of purpose. Well, if I'm on a supply chain, if I'm on an assembly line creating, you know, hamburger patties, you know, how do you create meaning? And so, but anyway, that's another more detailed question. Autonomy, I would sure help. But anyway, so Ellen, starting with you, is there certain key elements to job design that you bake into every assignment?
Absolutely. And there are some really excellent models of what constitutes a high quality job that are out there in the ecosystem. The Good Jobs Institute has a wonderful model. The Department of Labor, the Aspen Institute, the Jobs for the Future is another organization that has a really thoughtful model of what are the components of a high quality job. And we know that the basics, you know, the sort of foundational piece is that a job has to be one that does not put a worker in poverty. So we have to start with foundational, a floor level of wages and benefits that allow people to be effective at work. So if you are living in poverty, you are not likely to be able to be on time on a regular basis, et cetera. So that's sort of the first, the table stakes of a high quality job. And something that's interesting, the way the Good Jobs Institute looks at this with their Good Jobs Strategy, which is a terrific book, and a brand new book has come out called The Case for Good Jobs, you know, is to look at what Thomas was saying. Where are there low value activities that can be removed to allow employees to contribute more value in order to increase profitability, which enables even low margin businesses to pay, you know, a better wage? Once you have that basic floor of what is, you know, wages and benefits, then we can kind of look up to the next level about job characteristics that are known to be correlated with the kinds of business outcomes we care about, like lower levels of turnover, higher levels of engagement, et cetera. And so part of that is having a safe work environment. Do we have, you know, representation and voice? Are employees, you know, given the opportunity to add value to the process and to raise concerns with leadership? Supervision quality is extremely important and really is the fulcrum for many of these factors. And then a lot of what Thomas was talking about in terms of the elements, you know, of the job experience. So the extent to which people have a feeling of meaningfulness, the way they get feedback from the work, the way they perceive the organization to have their back or not. We mentioned autonomy a whole lot, task variety, whether their job is designed in such a way that one person can do the job. If you design a job that takes 1.5 people, you have an ineffective job design. So all of those are elements of what makes for a high quality job.
Thomas, that's a beautiful summary. And by the way, the Good Jobs Institute, that was created by a woman named Zeynep Tan. She's at MIT, and she has been a passionate advocate for this cause. Thomas, and by the way, that's why we have these good folks on the phone on this call, because Zeynep might be kind of hard to get. So here are two experts that might be a little bit easier to contact and use resources you could use. Anyway, Thomas, what's your view on sort of this framework of a good job? Again, it doesn't hurt even to repeat some things for people to, you know, get it into their head. Kind of what are the elements that go into a good job? And I'm thinking about any job. You know, it could be a newspaper delivery job. It could be the most rote job, telephone sales. What are the, how do you create meaning and engagement with jobs that don't have, aren't going to change the world jobs?
Yeah. So I think, I mean, right, there's plenty of research out there. I think the model that I like is the Hackman-Alter model, which basically says a good intrinsically motivating job has like three elements, right? Meaningful work, which, you know, is somebody does the entire job from start to finish, has can apply a variety of different skills to it, and knows that the work is meaningful for somebody else. The second element is autonomy, right? Being able to decide when the work gets done, how the work gets done, and having some discretion and being able to exercise some judgment there. And the third piece is knowledge of the results, right? So getting feedback, ideally from doing the work itself. The second best is obviously like the customer tells you. The third best is that the manager tells you, right? What we've done with that model is we added a fourth dimension, because this work was done in the 60s and 70s, the foundational work. And back then, technology didn't play a huge role in an organization. That has changed, obviously. And nowadays, I think technology has like really two aspects that really, I think, impact people's experience in the work. One is that the tool's got to be fit for purpose, right? So if you give people systems that don't work, or where people become sort of human middleware, they got to copy data from one system to another because there's no interface, that is a demotivator. And secondly, especially when it comes to knowledge work, is that we really have not thought about how we connect people in the workplace effectively. What I mean by that is that, you know, every knowledge worker gets bombarded with emails and Slack messages and text messages and you know, all these things consume attention capital. Right, we get constantly interrupted. I think the average knowledge worker gets about an email every 3 minutes. And so I think a lot of companies also have not really thought about how do we create conditions that allow people to do deep work and really concentrate on a task. And that's important, I think, both for people that do really brain surgery type work, right, that really need to concentrate. But it even applies to people that do kind of like, you know, really more administrative type work, like entering purchase orders and so forth, right? So we really have let technology get in the way of having people experience meaningful work. So in my view, those are the four elements. And the way to get at that is, quite frankly, to understand the experience that people have. How do they experience the job, right? So we're using a diagnostic tool that measures that, and that really gives you some pointers as to like what's missing, right? It's a little bit like when you're cooking a meal, right? What's the missing ingredient? Are we missing salt? Are we missing pepper? Right? What's not in the recipe? And so a diagnostic really helps you understand what the issues are. Is it the technology? Then let's fix the technology. Is it that people have the sense of, I have no sense of meaning? Can we connect people to the customer, to the outcome?
And now, so it seems to me here, what you're saying is that we really have to have a system for this, right? We have to, this can't be ad hoc. This is something that we have to do intentionally. So are there tools for productivity quality measurement that come into this? So for instance, if we wanted to have a gain sharing program, which could be used to create a sense of meaning, Ellen, I'll give you that one to start. And then we're still going to get to this choreography. I want to know how, what the deliverable is. What do I, as the employee and the owner, see out of the work if I hire you, in a sense? But let's look at the product. What kind of metrics can you use in job design, Ellen? And are they important if we're going to have gain sharing? That is, folks, when you share productivity and quality gains with employees.
Well, I think what Thomas said was so important with regard to, you know, these different elements of the job and the fact that they can be altered. You know, I think a lot of times when performance is low, an easy place for managers to go is to say, well, the problem is the people. We just have the wrong people in the job. People aren't doing a good job. They're not trying hard. They're not engaged. And when we look at the problem as the people, we miss huge opportunities to actually, as you were saying, change systems and to also look at places where we're having people do work that isn't inherently valuable to the business outcomes and therefore isn't inherently meaningful, right? Most people want to contribute to the success of the organization. And so what Thomas was saying about helping draw those connections between what I am doing and what the business is producing is really key. And metrics come into that picture, right? You know, we've all probably heard the story about someone who approaches a huge construction site and someone is sweeping the ground and person says, "Hey, what are you doing?" And they say, "I'm sweeping the floor." They approach someone else who's working much harder. And they say, "Well, what are you doing?" He says, "I'm building a cathedral." So that's an example. When we talk about things like gain sharing, I think any kind of open book management is really tapping into the desire of employees to contribute to the success of the organization, right? So that taps into the meaningfulness. It taps into that feedback from doing the work. So those types of metrics have to be relevant to the particular role. We did some research with a restaurant chain in Baltimore where they were talking about how a way to improve the profitability at a store level was to have the baristas encourage people to, you know, add a flavor shot. Would you like a vanilla shot with your espresso drink? Well, it's one more thing for a person to have to remember to do when they're extremely busy, right? And even when jobs are designed well, when there are lots of demands, people know what the most important thing is, right? Get people out the door with their coffee so the line doesn't get too long. When they introduced gain sharing and they gave them real data about the store's level of profitability, what the basic target was, and they knew that anything above that target level would be showing up in their paycheck at the end of the quarter. Well, that wasn't enough to actually motivate people to look at how they were doing their work differently. They had to know, where are the levers? So in the restaurant side, one of the things that was causing cost was lost silverware. Right? So be more careful when you're clearing off the dishes. But with the baristas, they recognized that the increased margin on any given drink was significant when you added that flavor shot. So that gave them the awareness that putting that extra little bit in to try to sell, upsell that flavor shot would make a difference in their paycheck. So there's a metric for you. It's all tracked, right? Every time you ring something up, what percentage of the time did this person, this barista, succeed in selling a flavor shot? And those are the types of things that when the awareness comes, it can be top of mind, even when work gets busy.
And so what I'm hearing here is that it's you're involving your employees, you're involving them, and you're giving them a sense of ownership, that an autonomy. That it, Thomas, and I'm still going to hold you both account to this choreography thing, but or me, don't let me forget it. You're really basically saying to the employee, hey, we're going to give you, okay, giving coffee, selling coffee isn't changing the world. Now, I do think it's a nice thing to make people happy. I enjoy great service. So I think there's plenty of meaning in that. But in case you're an existential New Yorker and could care less, well, there is meaning. There is meaning in having a concrete impact on my income through my ingenuity. So is that one of the ways that we create meaning in a job that otherwise, manufacturing ball bearings might at, face value seem meaningless, Thomas?
Yeah, I think at the bottom line, I think for me is like, to what extent do employees have a sense that they know how to win, right? How can I be successful, right? And so if you redesign the work and let's say you have, right, take the barista example, right? You have a store that says, right, we define the outcomes we're trying to achieve. We're putting a team together that's right, accountable and owns this from start to finish. Then people, I think, can oftentimes figure out really quickly what the key measures are that they need to know whether they're winning or losing, right, in this case. So back to your question about metrics, they become really apparent. Right. But in most organizations where work is highly fragmented, yeah, then you're stuck with measuring activities, not outcomes, right? Because then you check how many purchase orders have been entered, right? Whether we're done right or wrong, right? That pans out later on in the process, right? When the next person has to deal with that. So again, putting Humpty Dumpty back together, giving people a whole job to do, it's like a golfer, right? You swing, you hit the ball, you know how you're doing, you know how far off. Right, the final target point you are, right, and you can adjust and you can refine. The other piece in that is also, it's not just getting the metrics in there, but it's also giving people the autonomy and the degrees of freedom to do something about them, right? Nothing is more frustrating than measuring performance if people have no way to influence it.
It's an insane asylum, yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay, because I want to get to two other subjects before we, and one of them I didn't warn you about, but I'm sorry it came up, and that's AI. We'll get to that in a second, because I think it's actually going to have tremendous impact in job design, I hope, but we'll see. But, and we'll get to that, but I'll ask you. But Ellen, okay, I hire you, and I've hired you to design a specific type of manufacturing job, or I've hired you to really help me I have a new vice president of marketing. My company is siloed. There's all sorts of issues here. Before I just spend another $300,000 on this woman, I really want to make sure this job makes sense. So I hire you. What is the product I get? I kind of get, understand you're going to involve, you're going to try to establish the purpose, goals, objectives, mission of the job and of the organization. Those tasks, et cetera, all of those things. But at the end of the day, what is my end product as an employer when I've hired you?
Well, I think I'm going to give you a researcher's answer, which is always, well, it depends. And it's complicated, right? And I think Thomas knows what I'm talking about in the sense that these engagements are always very bespoke because each organization with its unique set of goals and challenges also knows on some level where it's done its Pareto analysis. It knows where the 80% can be achieved from the 20% that can be addressed kind of as the low hanging fruit. So in my experience, when you talk with senior leadership, they have a very good view of what does it take to win at the organizational level. We would then kind of go down to that next level to understand what are the operational challenges? And frankly, we find human resource leaders to be a really valuable source of information about where there are operational challenges. Now, oftentimes people think, oh, HR, they really are just dealing with benefits and employee problems. But HR has a really unusual view of the whole operation and the ways in which people pieces interact. So understanding from HR, from operational leaders, but also from frontline supervisors, and then from workers themselves. So we, as researchers, we use mixed methods. So we're doing a lot of direct conversation and interviewing with management and leadership to get that organizational perspective. We have, you know, proprietary survey instruments, but we do a lot of bespoke survey design as well, depending upon what it is we want to know from workers about the particular challenges. And where we would come from that really is, in addition to this diagnostic, you know, we use the scientific evidence base to build an action plan. And I'll refer you all to a resource of the job quality maps that we created based on over 3,000 peer-reviewed scientific studies in partnership with the National Fund for Workforce Solutions with generous support from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And that really is a good sort of place to start your roadmap to say, what do we know about what characteristics of jobs correlate with which human capital KPIs, you know, are our biggest challenge, right? Turnover may be your biggest challenge, but it might be engagement in healthcare, particularly during the pandemic. Everyone said, oh, the problem is turnover, but very often the problem was burnout, which was the cause of the turnover. So looking at that as a place to start with an action plan, once we have that diagnostic of understanding where the issues are and really using worker voice, that allows us then build an action plan that, you know, can be executed. That actual execution may or may not be something that we engage with. Like, for example, if we see that there's a problem with wage equity and it's really hurting people's perceptions of fairness on the job and their willingness to be engaged in the work, a wage equity audit is in order. That's not something we would do, but these are the ways in which we, you know, can kind of point our clients and our partners, you know, to the types of resources that they need, you know, to execute on a plan. And these, it's very important to remember, this is not a quick fix, right? These just a long-term process of creating and changing systems. But that is that's really the only way to make the kind of meaningful change that's going to affect the bottom line in the long term.
So in your work, a business plan, a product might actually be a series of specific recommendations for the system, let's say, of jobs that they required. Or I would imagine it could get as granular as a detailed job description, I would think, couldn't it? And I'll let you answer that, Thomas. But also, even though as a job design specialist, you're not going to design a rewards or recognition program, but I would think in your analysis, you might find that they have one that's meaningless, or they have one that's pissing people off, or that maybe they don't have one, that they need one. So I'll let you quickly answer that. And then, Thomas, I want your view a little bit on what the deliverable would be like. And then we're going to touch quickly on work at home and AI before we wrap up.
Well, I'll add that our attorney would absolutely never allow us to make a recommendation. We would, however, present a suggested approach. Because every organization needs to make the judgment for themselves about what will be effective and what won't. And as outsiders, we bring in a unique view, but ultimately it's really up to the organization to take those steps and to execute. And I agree with you, you know, for example, if we discover that people don't feel that they're recognized for the work they do, then examining recognition systems may be one of the suggestions that comes out of this work. However, very often, recognition isn't about a program. Recognition is about one's relationship with a supervisor. So perceived supervisor support is an important measure that we look at in our diagnostic. And when Thomas was talking about the effects of Taylorism, the effects of McKenzieism over time too has been to look at how do we engineer lower costs by increasing the span of control. So in other words, having more employees report to a single manager, the manager being a more expensive resource, and then de-skilling the job such that individual workers don't need as much guidance to do the work. But when we increased span of control, each supervisor has less time for that relationship with the employee. And that's where recognition happens, right? So there's some really interesting research going on at Harvard Business School, where they're looking at what if we did reduce span of control? What if we add more supervisors, reduce the number of employees who are reporting to them as a way to try to increase that perceived supervisor support, which we know from research is tied to business KPIs. So that's the type of thing that a suggestion may come about that has nothing to do with buying another program, or increasing someone's compensation, but that really goes to the heart of what makes for a high quality job.
Well, very interesting. I'm going to turn it over to you, Thomas, to finish off on that subject of deliverable. But Ellen, very interestingly, someone I know works for a fantastic company. I can't mention it. It's a leading engineering company. Just a great company. They are a stakeholder capitalist company in every way. Every employee has a manager who checks in on them every 2 weeks with a scheduled appointment. And the manager is not an HR person per se. It is a project management leader who they are just checking in on your welfare. And all, what's going on in the job? What issues are you facing? Are you facing obstacles off the record? Are you having interpersonal challenges? And by doing this and on a scheduled basis, it saves the company millions of dollars because this company makes billion-dollar machines. So you make a mistake due to bad communication, $10 million out the door. So that is the type of thing that I think really can facilitate job design when you have someone all the time checking in on them. So Thomas,
we're actually working on a case study of a tomato products manufacturer taking a very similar approach. And they're doing that down to the actual workers on the line.
Every mm-hmm. I have technical workers, everybody has that. And the person has 30 or 40 people. That's it. That's who she meant. And it's part of his or her job to check in on everybody, on all elements, even personal. Is there a problem in your life? Are you have financials, whatever the person feels comfortable talking about. Thomas, so just we've covered a lot of stuff, but just kind of wrapping up on deliverables. I've hired you to help me. What would that might look? I know it's bespoke. I get it, but I get a schematic. What do I get? Recommendations? What do I get?
I think let's talk about the results, right? Because I think that's ultimately, right, when people do something like this is what they're looking for, right? And I think what you get is you get more productivity because as you put the job spec together, you eliminate all the white space in the organization. You also oftentimes get lower cost because now you don't need oodles and oodles of supervisors to tell people what to do it, when to do it, and then check whether they've done it, right? Because again, as you do the job design, you maximize the autonomy appropriately. You don't need this tight supervision that we currently have. So you get more productivity. You also get higher levels of engagement and lower turnover. People don't leave well-designed jobs. If people question that, right, just look at the school system. Teachers don't get paid well. Everybody knows that, right? But those jobs are well-designed for the most part, right? People own the classroom, right? They can see whether, right? Both of my parents are teachers. I know a ton of teachers, right? A teacher knows when a kid is struggling or when a kid is thriving, right? They have autonomy, they get feedback, and the work is incredibly meaningful, right? So people don't leave these jobs, although the pay is ridiculous, right, for such an important task. So if you design the job, turnover drops next to nothing because nobody who lived in a well-designed job wants to go back into like a classic Tayloristic model where all the decision-making is concentrated at the top. The third thing you get is you get much higher customer satisfaction because if you design the jobs right, people can actually feel accountability, right? They can own the work product, right? They can make sure that the customer gets what they want. So you get more satisfied customers, you get higher levels of accountability. Take the typical organization. When something goes wrong, the typical response is like, it's either before me or after me, right? Somebody else screwed up, right? But when you actually design the jobs well, people can be accountable because they own that specific work product. So I look at it like from that business perspective. And then I think there's softer things you get. I think you get growth, right? If you design the jobs well, employees can grow. So we get out of this like transactional model of like, I hire people for doing X. If X changes, get rid of the person, because now I need to hire somebody to do right X2, right? The next version of this. And if you design jobs well, people can grow in them. And that's not just true for frontline employees. That's also true for managers. If you go back to Peter Drucker's seminal work on management from 1973, right? You look it up, it says there, you can't design the job of a manager big enough because you don't want people to get bored. You don't want people to hit the ceiling of the job after 6 months. You want them to be able to grow, right? And grow the scope of responsibilities. So again, I think from my point of view, I think this is a fantastic investment, right? Because oftentimes, the cost of turnover shows up in no P&L, right? People leave, we need to, right? Work doesn't get done while people are out. People need to interview. We bring the new person in. It takes them 3-6 months to get up to speed.
It's all buried, right? Yep, yeah. Just like defects were during total quality management. We just buried. We just accepted 10% defects. Well, that's going to change. So one other thing on this score of this choreography. So what the deliverable might be a report. If it's a systematic approach where you lay out, you know, the gap analysis and make specific recommendations on how to design jobs. But I would imagine it could get as granular as, say, I know at Trader Joe's, they literally have designed the jobs. They're choreographed. You never do the same thing. I've been told, I don't even know I've ever shopped in a Trader Joe's, but I've been told that the employees are moved around throughout the day. They're taught new skills. They might be in the bakery department one day. They might be moved to produce the other day. They might participate in a training program. So would you actually map out in your recommendations ways for companies specifically to structure jobs that would include all of these elements you've mentioned in writing with a schematic or something?
Yeah, I mean, you go even further, right? You actually do it. Right. I mean, one thing is like, you know, here's a nice report. Good luck implementing it. Right. But we all know, right, that's a huge change management challenge. Right. How do you get people from A to B? How do you get to the other side of this? Right. Because you change something, initially performance drops, people are struggling. Right. They need some help to get to the other side. So in our work, right, we really try to get people to the other side. And yes, the artifacts that you afterwards have are job descriptions and so forth, right? But it's really the implementation that matters. And sometimes you find that, you know, it was a great plan on paper, right? But once you actually start executing it, you realize that there are 50 other issues that you weren't aware of, you know? People call it the iceberg of ignorance, right? Management knows 4% of the issues. The frontline workers know 100%, right? Mm-hmm. So again, you do that with people, you co-design it with them, and you probably need to tweak it and refine it. And then, yeah, ultimately, you write that down in the job description. But job descriptions, right, they're outdated at the moment, right? You hit the save button, right? The work's already changed, right? So I think it's really important also under the guise of agility, right, to really not just make this a one-off exercise, but also to give everybody in the organization, right, the tools, the language, a methodology to make further refinements, because it's not static, right? It changes all the time.
Well, that's great. And we have a few more minutes, so I want to get to a couple of more potentially controversial issues. First off, work from home. Ellen, I've always allowed, when I ran companies with a bunch of employees, the tremendous flexibility because I believed in autonomy and ownership. So I've never had a problem with that at all. Do you think there's a lot of old-fashioned people of my generation, the baby boomers who were supposed to change the world, huh? A lot of us are actually carried on what our parents did. What is your advice to CEOs, Ellen, you first, and then Thomas, about making smart decisions about work from home rather than shoot from the hip? Can you use job design strategies to kind of figure that out, Ellen?
Oh, absolutely. And I think you hit on an important factor, which is that where we each sit determines what we can see, right? So I may be sitting up in the C-suite and have a particular way that I like to work with my team. And I can make a sweeping generalization and say, well, I like to manage by walking around. Therefore, I should bring all of my workers back into the office. And that will make our organization more creative and effective. But the research that exists so far demonstrates that actually organizations seem to function best when A, people get to make determinations for themselves, but a hybrid arrangement where the purpose of being in the office is to bring teams together to co-work, that seems to be the most effective. Demanding that people show up to do work that they could do virtually is counterproductive. So again, that's partly when we talk about job design is you need to understand and raise employee voice to get that understanding. What is it that people are doing? Where can the activities be most effectively executed? So if I'm doing, as Thomas was saying, deep work, I may be more effective in the office if my childcare situation involves children in the home. But if I am someone who works without distractions in my house, that may be more effective for me. So the nature of the work is a very important element in making determinations about where people do it. But when what the research has shown so far is that when hybrid arrangements are not arbitrary, it's not a one size fits all, but for example, the team has the autonomy to say, we want to be in the office one day a week to do co-working that is better done in person. But for us, it's got to be Tuesday. Another team might say it's got to be twice a week and it really should be Monday and Wednesday. So a one size fits all approach is a problem, but using the autonomy of teams and individuals to make that determination, that's the superpower that CEOs should tap into.
So it seemed to me that companies like Amazon that are trying to just arbitrarily force everybody back in, I almost think they're doing it to just get people to leave, because that is an invitation to get people to leave. Especially, I've heard that the way they've done it is, if you don't make a decision very quickly, you're essentially going to have to resign and not get benefits. That's another story. But Thomas, would your advice to be to most CEOs, if you have a one-size-fit-all approach to bringing back to the office, you are taking a big risk?
Yeah, you got to have a really strong brand, right? I mean, you got to be like Goldman Sachs, right? Where, right, you throw oodles of money at people and, you know, it's a great brand, right? So people probably put up with like a lot more, right? My advice would be just as Alan said, right? I think one, it depends on the nature of the work. If you're in a manufacturing plant, people don't have the luxury of working from home, right? So if you're, right, if you're a supermarket employee that restocks the shelves, can't do that from home, right? So you got to look at the work. I think you got to put people in a room and say, what is all the work that we're doing in whatever the organization, department, function is? Think about how do we make these jobs better, right? So instead of just right saying, well, gee, you know, come in Tuesday, come in Thursday, but do the same stuff. Let's leverage the levers of work design, right? Entire job, variety of skills and so forth to restructure the work and then see to what extent that work is best done by yourself without distractions versus with others and in the office. And again, people are smart, right? I guess you guide them through that. They can figure it out and say, you know, no, for this task, right? I really need to sit with Mary and Joe and we need to work this out. And that needs to happen twice a week. And then you can have a conversation around like how that happens, right? But also that process really creates ownership, right? Nobody washes a rental car. Nobody in the history of rental cars has ever come back and said to Hertz, you know, I ran it through the washer, you know, it's all clean. I also vacuumed the back seat, you know. Nobody's ever done this. How do we expect employees to really take ownership and accountability if we exclude them from all the decision-making about like right, what the job is, where the job gets done, how the work gets done, how much autonomy they should have, right? And I think that's a dialogue. I think that's way overdue. I think, quite frankly, it's also going to be liberating for managers. Because these one-size-fits-all mandates, what do? That's, as a CEO, you can make the mandate. But the guy who's holding the bag is like the director-level person who then gets the memo from corporate headquarters that says, your people don't show up. And that person knows that if they really crack down on this, the people that have options are going to go somewhere else.
And it's so the
now you create a hiring problem, right? Now you got to hire 15 more people, and then you get dinged because your performance suffers, right? So I think that's also, I think you see that in every organization that has these mandates, right? They start strong at the top, but by the time it gets down to the, right, where it matters, where the rubber hits the road, people are like, you know, hey, boss, if you really want me to enforce this, we're going to have a problem for the next 6 months because we're going to have nobody to do the work. Well, in today's environment, there's a lot of open jobs, right? People actually, right? That there's more jobs than workers. So I think people are should be very careful and really understand what their position is. The other thing is,
hold on,
you
Thomas,
can only pull this card once.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Tom, got to stop. Yeah. Thomas, I love what you're saying, but we got just a few more minutes. And you're absolutely right on everything you're saying. I want to get quickly to, well, just to wrap up on what you're saying and what both of you said, folks. No one side. If you want to have a good business right now, it seems to me the work for home thing, Tom and Thomas and Ellen, has created a great opportunity for you two. Because if I were running a company right now, I'd be rethinking every job. I would probably want to call on experts like you right now to really think and be strategic and systematic about it, because I am sure that 90% of companies are not trained in this, and it's ready, aim, fire. They don't know what they're doing, and I think this is a great opportunity to be in your business. So a wrap up on AI. Both of you have mentioned, you know, being able to get rid of jobs that are or tasks that are less meaningful. And everybody is scared of AI, but I've lived through massive, I'm old enough to have seen massive change, tons of predictions that were never true. The internet was supposed to disrupt it, but get paper. There's more paper than ever. So I'm not really as concerned as others are, although I may be wrong, on the front of losing jobs. Because can't this create new jobs, AI? Ellen, what do you think? Can it make lower level jobs more meaningful? You're muted.
Well, you ask whether it can create jobs. I mean, it certainly will and has, and people need to design AI. People need to consider the ethics of AI. People need to figure out how to integrate AI into existing work. Where can work be redesigned or shifted such that AI is doing pieces of it? That, you know, I think about the practice of law that will be significantly affected by AI. But I think that looking at AI as another tool to serve our clients or produce our products in a more effective way, and looking at AI as a tool to make people more effective is probably the winning strategy. Looking at AI as a tool to replace people, I think what you're really talking about is replacing low value tasks as opposed to replacing individual people. I think that we will all need to do is to be very mindful of ways in which change is taking place and to be cautious about, first of all, drawing conclusions without, you know, adequate data, but also getting stuck in a particular approach, because the change is going to evolve very quickly, and keeping a finger on the pulse, both of what is happening in technology, but also what is happening with the actual, you know, implementation on the ground of that technology. So I think employee listening is going to be more important than ever as AI starts to play out in the workplace.
And this issue, Thomas, of using AI, I love what you said, by the way. Can it be, and I love the idea of using it to improve tasks rather than remove jobs. What about involving, you guys have talked all along about voice, worker voice. What about involving our employees in the issue? You said involve employees in work design and involve employees in work from home. What about involving employees on how to use AI? What are your final thoughts on AI and its implication on job design?
Yeah, I think one is, I think a lot of these technologies, right? And unless you, let's say, take a ChatGPT 4.0 and just plug it in, right? And you work with this. But a lot of companies really need to train these large language models on their specific knowledge base, right? To get value out of it and correct the mistakes, right? All these systems hallucinate. So you actually need people to train the software for AI to deliver. So this idea of like, we can just plug that in and then 50 people go, is, I think, an illusion, right? Because like, take insurance, right? Underwriters, right? People are talking about the underwriter of the future and all this technology is going to replace all the underwriters for the last 15 years, right? Hasn't happened yet. Why? Because, you know, you plug the model in, you get the wrong answer, right? So people need to train these models. That changes the nature of the job. again, that's what we say, okay, for the next 5 years, as we deploy this, there are opportunities to become more productive and efficient. It's going to change the nature of the existing jobs. How do we, right? How do we make these jobs meaningful and impactful for people? So message number one is you don't get there without the people, right? Message number two is, I think if we're limiting ourselves to kind of like eliminating labor costs, I think that's a very short-sighted view, because AI does not invent new products, identify new markets, identify unmet needs. At least I haven't seen that yet, right? And so that's something that human beings can do, because humans have imagination, right? We can use judgment. We can put things in perspective. These AI tools, they just give us a statistical answer as like, what's the next logical word that should come after IMA, right? And so I think companies gets, everybody gets enamored with technology, right? It's been ERP systems are supposed to like, you know, get rid of all this crazy work. To your point, no, it hasn't happened yet, right? I think there's also, I think, a real risk for companies to over-automate and really just create a horrible customer experience.
Oh.
Right? Because all these chatbots, right? I mean, we all tried them. 98% of people hate them, right? Unless you have a really simple question, right? These things don't help you, right? So I think companies got to be really careful to drive customer value. And again, it's like, right, partner with the employees to create the work of the future rather than decide in the ivory tower and then try to force it down people's throats.
That's a perfect end right there. Thank you. Really beautifully said. Folks, thank you so much for this. Really, really, even for me, who knows more about job design than most regular folk, what I took out of this is that really, there's never been a more important time for your job, for your career, your professions. Number one, because we all know that employee engagement recognition programs have been used for 20 years and they don't work the way most of them are done. Employee engagement is still rock bottom. Customer satisfaction is still rock bottom. So something isn't working, okay? And job design cannot happen without the CEO, the CEO, recognizing that it's a part of the strategy. But I think the other reason why you guys are in such a good business right now is because of the incredibly high turnover. The fact that the younger generation, like when we were younger, said that they wanted to have more meaningful work. Now, whether they grow up like us, like we did, I'm a little older than you folks, and realized and really ended up like their parents, I'm not going to say. But right now, they're looking for meaning and they're shopping for meaning, and we know that they are. So, and we also know that you right now, you want to be a bus driver. There are something like 50,000 bus driver unfilled jobs right now. And that's a meaningful job. So I think your work really is, I think with AI, we're going to need to grapple with how do we design jobs? Because AI, as you said, is a tool. It is not, doesn't replace people. It's a tool that makes, gives people greater power, like the internet, I think anyway. And then this whole issue of work from home. I think it really does require us to be mindful about it. And I think the two of you will both agree. How, I'll give you both a trick question. And all your, both of you have had tons of years of experience, and we're not going to insult anybody. But when it comes to managing people, how strategic and systematic and holistic, what is the maturity level of companies when it comes to be on a scale of 10, strategic, systematic, clear metrics, worker voice, continuous improvement, on a scale of 1 to 10, what is the average rate of maturity in the U.S. today in terms of strategic people management? Ellen, 1 to 10.
There are always leaders and everyone needs to follow that example. So I can't give a, I can't give you a number on that.
Well, I'm not going to push you to insult anybody, but do you think that the average company out there that you encounter has a strategic and systematic approach to people with clear metrics, et cetera, and a continuous improvement process? Has that been the norm?
I think it very much depends on the maturity of the company and the growth cycle. We do a lot of work supporting private equity firms, portfolio companies, and that building that function, building that strategic human resource management is one of the success factors in value creation. So building that function is not something that happens necessarily early on, unless you happen to be the workforce and organizational research center, but it's an important part of the evolution that makes companies successful.
Thomas, and you're a very political woman, and I credit you for that. I'm not. Thomas, maybe you want to be as political, and I'll let you be that way.
Well,
I'm teasing you, Alan. You know that.
So I think it's relatively low, right? Let's say it's five, right? And I'm being generous here, right? But I think that also just speaks to the size of the opportunity, right? The issues that we're seeing today, they're not a design flaw. They're a feature of the approach that we use to design jobs. It's just like we've been using the same thinking that you know we did around 1920, right? I think it's time to upgrade that at least to like the 1960s, 70s. Right? So I think it's a tremendous upside. Think about this. It's like, you know, it's like the advantage you're getting, right, when you actually go on this journey and take that all the way through, right? You get out of this transactional mode of like, I need a warm body to fill a seat, right? You really build, I think, an organization that's healthy, right? If people are involved, right, the cultural indicators go up. There's a ton of benefits to be had, right? And I think some companies are further along in that journey. There definitely, I think, some companies I would probably say are like at like an 8 or 9. Nobody gets a 10. Right. And there are some companies that are right god awful and are at a right, -5. Right.
But they might still make money and free enterprise if it's legal.
Yeah.
So, folks, thank you again for this really enlightening session. And this will be published as an article and shared with our readers for years to come because you've given us terrific, great advice. Thank you.
Thank you for having us, Bruce.
My pleasure.
Many thanks for the conversation. It was terrific.
Thank you.